Let me just, hopefully it'll work this time. Okay. Looking forward to learning together. I had thought that we had exhausted our topic. I had thought that we had spent a lot of sessions on the history of tefillah, and maybe it was time to move on. But I think there's a bit more that seems kedai, that seems fitting to talk about. And so I figured that we would have two more sessions on this specific mini topic, the history of tefillah. Today we'll talk about tefillah during the Second Temple era, and next time when we meet, which is not next week but in 2 weeks, we will talk about the post-Second Temple era, and that will conclude our mini foray into the history of tefillah. So today's shiur is really going to be part one of two. We're going to look at the Second Temple era, we're going to look at tefillah during the Second Temple era, and the truth is, the reason why, even though you can technically segment it into part, shiur number one is Second Temple, and then next week we're going to do post-Second Temple. Things we learn next week will answer questions we are going to pose this week. So in that way, the classes are really going to be related. So for those of you who are new, just to catch people up, over the past several weeks, we've been discussing the history of tefillah. And what I mean by that is not the history of prayer or any specific piece of the liturgy, but really tefillah in general. What did tefillah look like, and how has tefillah changed and developed since the creation of the world? And we started with the creation of the world, and last week we had our most recent installment, which was the first, which covered from the first exile of the Holy Land to the return to the temple and the establishment of Shemona Esrei around that time. So right now, what we're up to in history, this is where we're holding, so to speak. Shemona Esrei has just been established. The Second Temple is thriving. And you might think that we're done, right? Shemona Esrei that's what we do today. We've gotten from point A to point B, and we still say the Shemona Esrei nowadays. And the truth is that, yes, we have covered a lot of ground since the world was created. But the truth is that while the institution of Shemona Esrei around the time of the reestablishment of the Second Temple was probably the largest and most consequential development in the history of tefillah, maybe even ever, it is not the end of the story, which is why we're meeting to talk about this right now. And so today we'll talk about what will finally be, or almost finally be, the second to last part in this mini-series about the history of tefillah. We'll discuss tefillah from the establishment of Shemona Esrei, where we left off last time, through the destruction, or really until the destruction of the Second Temple. And if last week was the most drastic development in the history of tefillah, then this week may just be the most interesting. Because the truth is that the history of tefillah during this period is deceptively simple. It seems straightforward. What kinds of questions could you have? Shemona Esrei was established. What else is there to talk about? That's what we have. We've arrived at where we are today. But it's not true. It's not true. The Second Temple era raises some very interesting questions about the relationship between sacrifice and prayer, about attempts to preserve and save Judaism in the face of the Second Temple's destruction, and we'll even talk a little bit about the very concept of change itself. And so let's just take the proverbial temperature for a moment. Right now, it's about 538 BCE. The temple has just been built, or is about to be built, it's being built, and we're at the very beginning of the Second Temple era. Temple service has resumed, which is a big deal after our first exile. Temple service has resumed, and many Jews are back in the Holy Land, though not all, not even most. Many Jews did not come back after the first exile. They stayed in exile. But Jews are back in the Holy Land. The temple service has been resumed, and the Beit HaMikdash, at least in some form, has already been built. Consider the following example, a testament to this, from the Mishnah in Tamid. Shemona Esrei, we know from anecdotes that we are about to read, we spoke about last week how it was established. We can see in these texts that we're about to read that people had already started to adopt that practice of praying Shemona Esrei. Consider the following example from the Mishnah in Tamid. Meseches Tamid is one of the less studied, but still very, very worthwhile and interesting tractates. It deals with the daily service of the Kohanim in the Beit HaMikdash. And the Kohen, this Mishnah says, who was supervising the other Kohanim in the temple, who was called the Memuna, the appointed one, Amar Lehem HaMemuna, in the first source on the page, Baruch Hu Beracha Achat. He would tell the other Kohanim in the temple, bless one blessing, make a bracha. Now, which bracha was this? It wasn't that they can just make a shahak, or they can make whatever bracha they wanted to. This, the Gemara in Brachos, towards the beginning of Maseches Brachos, says this was a reference to the bracha of Ahava Rabba, the first bracha that preceded Shemona, that preceded the Kriyat Shema. We usually have how many bracha that precede Kriyat Shema in the morning and at night? Two. There's Yotzir Or and there's Ahava Rabba. Those are the two brachos that precede Kriyat Shema. But here, the Kohanim only had to recite one, the Mishnah says. They only had to recite the bracha of Ahava Rabba. Does anybody want to take a guess at why? The reason why is because this was very early in the morning. And the bracha of Yotzer Or, which deals with God's creation of light, should best be said when you can actually appreciate and benefit from that light. And so the Kohanim did not say the first bracha of Shema, they only said the second one. And the halacha is that the bracha of Kriyat Shema can be recited out of order. It's still going to be valid. And so they said bracha of Ahava Rabba. That's what our Mishnah says. Vehein Barchu. And they did so. And then the Mimuna said, Karu Aseret HaDvarim. Then he told them to say the Ten Commandments, which they did. They recited the Ten Commandments. And then they said Shema, Vahayim Shemoa, and Vayomer. They said the three paragraphs of Kriyat Shema. Berchu et ha'am shalosh brachot. And then they gave three, they recited three blessings. It says berchu et ha'am, but the commentaries point out that this was not them blessing the people. It's a big machloket. Why then it says bless the people? Some say no, they were saying it around the same time that the rest of the nation was saying it, but it wasn't that they were literally blessing the people. But in any case, Berchu et ha'am shalosh brachot. Then they would recite three brachot. They would say the following three brachot. Emet v'yatziv. They would say the first bracha that comes after Kriyat Shema in the morning, v'yatziv. And then they would say v'avoda. And then they would say, does anybody know what the bracha of avoda refers to? I don't want to take a guess.
The temple.
But what bracha? What bracha are we talking about? We're talking here about the bracha of Ritzeh. The bracha of Ritzeh in Shemona Esrei, which deals with the avoda, which deals with the temple service, and that's why it's called Birchas HaAvoda, because it deals with the temple service. And then they said Birchas Kohanim. And it's not really clear what this Birkas Kohanim means, by the way. Because the Birkas Kohanim, and they would do the hands, and they would bless the nation, Yivarechach Hashem, that actually happened later in the day. That was not this Birkas Kohanim. So what was this Birkas Kohanim? So some Mefarshim say that, yeah, they actually did it two times. They did it once in front of the, you know, once in public, but they did it in private when they were still getting ready for the day. And others say that it actually refers not to the bracha of Yivarechach Hashem Yitzracha, but to the bracha of Sim Shalom. So the last bracha of Shemona Esrei. That's what this bracha is that the Kohanim were reciting. And then the Mishnah continues that on Shabbos they would add on a bracha. Okay, so there's a lot to talk about in this Mishnah, but we see from it several things. We see, number one, that the Kohanim, even in the Second Temple era, were already incorporating some of the blessings that were established by the Anshei Knesset HaGedola to be part of Shemona Esrei. Ritzeh and Sim Shalom, potentially, depending on how you understand the bracha of Birkas Kohanim and what that is a reference to. But what we see also, though, is something else that's very interesting. What we see also is that, or really a question you can ask, is the Anshei Knesset HaGedola had established the Shemona Esrei, right? We just finished that. That's what we learned last week. Why weren't the Kohanim reciting the full Shemona Esrei? Why were they only saying one, maybe two, of the brachot in the mornings? They were only reciting a small part of it, and a very small part of it at that. Didn't the Anshei Knesset HaGedola establish Shemona Esrei for everyone? Why were the Kohanim saying some parts of the liturgy, but not others? So this is a question that we can hope to answer as we progress through the sources. But it also raises another fundamental question. If question number one is why were the Kohanim only saying some of the brachot of Shemona Esrei if the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah had just instituted Shemona Esrei? Question number two, and this is maybe even a more awkward question, our Mishnah said that the Kohanim serving in the Beit HaMikdash would say the bracha of which one? Which one? Ritzei. They would say Ritzei. And what does the bracha of Ritzei discuss? If you look in the second source, this is the bracha of Ritzei as it appears in the Ashkenazi Sidur. Ritzei Hashem Elokeinu ba'amcha Yisrael lebit filatam. Be pleased with our service and hashev et ha'avodah lidvir beitecha. And restore temple service. And accept the prayers of your people Israel with favor. And return us to Tzion with mercy. What's the difficulty here? They had it. They were already there. So if our Mishnah says that the Kohanim said the bracha of Ritzei, then how does that square with the bracha of Ritzei as a prayer that we will return to temple service and that we will return to Tzion? We were already there. In fact, the Mishnah that says they said the bracha of Ritzei is dealing specifically with people in the Beis HaMikdash. People in the Beis HaMikdash were davening for a return to the Beis HaMikdash. It doesn't seem to make a lot of sense.
But you said that many of the people were not.
Great point. So many of the people did not go back, and I think that can answer the last part. Help us return to Tzion. Help us return to Tzion because many people were not in Tzion. But the line, Hashev et Ha'avoda, they were there performing the service. Whether or not there were people outside the land of Israel or inside the land of Israel, temple service had resumed. So why are we davening for temple service to resume? It's very strange. And in fact, the truth is that this relates to many of the brachot in Shemona Esrei that were established by the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah. Vili Yerushalayim also returned to Yerushalayim. Ritzei, they all returned to Hashiva Shofteinu, returned to our judges. In fact, it was Ezra and his judges that established this version of Shemona Esrei. So what place do these brachot have in a liturgy that was already existing when so many of the things that we daven for today were already around? It's a big kashya, I think, on our Shemona Esrei.
Was it the second temple, though, the sanctity of the second temple truncated from the first?
Yeah, that's true. That's true. So maybe you can say that we're asking for a better version of the second temple or a holier version of the second temple. It could be. But then again, there are lines that seem to explicitly request things from that we already have. It doesn't say we want a holier version of the sacrifices that we're offering. It says we want to start offering sacrifices.
Well, maybe they thought that was intuitively obvious that it should be returning to what happened.
That it was intuitively obvious that when they were asking for it to start, they meant for a better one to...
People must have realized that they don't have what they had in the first temple. They had the level of the shrine was completely markedly diminished.
Yeah, it could be. I find that...
Or the word return also being interpreted as keep us here.
It could be, but there we have words for that in Hebrew. We have other words for that in Hebrew. So one answer you can give is that Ezra and his Beit Din maybe established this before they returned to the land. We said last week we didn't know exactly when this happened. Maybe they established it, these tefillot, while they were still in exile. But then it also raises the question, why did they keep saying it when they returned? So I want to turn your attention to a teshuva of the Tashbetz. The Tashbetz was Rabbi Shimon ben Tzemach Duran. He was a 14th to 15th century rabbi. He was nifter in 1444, is an easy date to remember. He was a posek. He was a philosopher. He also trained and practiced as a physician. He lived in Spain. He lived in Algiers as well. And he wrote many works, including Teshuvot, and in one of his Teshuvot, he addresses our question. And he writes, and let's read what he writes. It's the last source on page number one, the Tashbetz in Chilik Bet, Simon Kuf Samech Aleph. He says, "Ubelo Safek, I have no doubt She'ein nusach hatfila she'anu mitpalalin hayom kenusach she'ayu mitpalalin b'fnei habayin. There is no doubt that the text that we use for tefillah today is different than the one that they used to pray in temple times. She'anu mitpalalin she'tachzor malchus beis Davidim koma. Because we daven for the return of the Davidic dynasty. V'she'yibana beit hamikdash b'mhera v'yameinu. And that the Beit HaMikdash should be built speedily in our times. U'kesheit kavtsu n'futzoteinu. The bracha of tekal b'shofar gadol l'chiruteinu v'san ish l'kabetz galiyoteinu. And we daven for all that. V'hem hayu mitpalalin. So that was not what they davened. He says it doesn't make any sense. It must be that we davened differently than they daven. V'hem hayu mitpalalin. So what did they daven? Shetit kayin malchus beis David. Like you said, that it should stay, that it should endure. V'shalo yecharav beit hamikdash. We daven for it to be rebuilt. They daven for it not to be destroyed. V'shalo yigalu Yisrael me'artzam. And we daven for kibbutz galuyot. We daven for the nations to be brought back into the land. They daven that they should not be exiled. So the truth is that according to the Tashbitz, he resolves our question, he answers it, and he says, yeah, velo suffik. He says there's no way that what we're davening for is what they're davening for. They must have davened for a slightly different version. All of these things were important to them, but whereas we daven for these things to happen, they davened for them to not happen. We daven for the Beit HaMikdash to be rebuilt, they daven for it not to be destroyed. We daven for the ingathering of exiles, they daven for the exiles never to be dispersed. And then he continues.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
What does he base that? I mean, apart from the inconsistencies and the fact that it doesn't make any sense, what, you know, that they would be dominating for the same thing.
I don't think it's anything more than logic. I think that he's faced with a contradiction, and he says the only way to resolve that contradiction is to say that the tefillot must have been different in temple times. He doesn't quote a source. And you know, this is responsa literature. This is the place to quote sources if you have them. He doesn't quote any sources, which makes me think that it must be a logical conclusion on his own part. I think it's a good question.
So presumably, the language they used was not the language that we've been talking about, and the words that they used.
Correct.
Different words.
Correct. According to the Tashbitz, it had to have been a different language, otherwise they would be praying for the same things we are, since they were praying for something else. Must have been they used another language. And then he adds at the end, Kishehayamit palel biyom hakipurim birchas ritzei lo hayamit palel ota al hanusach shelanu. And when he davened, when the Kohen Gadol would daven ritzei on Yom Kippur, he would use a different text. The same thing too. He says in benching, Bonei Yerushalayim, the bracha of Bonei Yerushalayim, to rebuild Yerushalayim in benching, he says, Ubelo suffix, shelo hayu al nusach zeh. It must be that we changed the nusach at some point. Because it doesn't make sense for them to daven that Yerushalayim should be rebuilt when Yerushalayim was rebuilt. It had been rebuilt. They had returned. This is really from Shlomo, who set up, according to the Gemara, who set up Bnei Yerushalayim. So this is even from Bayit Rishon. But again, the first exile hadn't even happened. So he says it must have been that the Nusach we have today, in his words, Nusach HaTfilah She'anu Mitpalalin Hayom, Ein K'Nusach She'hayu Mitpalalin Bifnei Habayit. That the Nusach of Tfilah that we have today was not theirs. Yeah. Yeah. I think that the key difference between now and then is the temple. Is that they had the temple, and that's a much more complete version of redemption than what we have now. We have the state of Israel. It's a great thing. But even when they were back in their state, they still davened for the ingathering of the exiles. So you're hitting on something. This is a great point. Exactly. So what he says is that they davened for them to stay. And if you notice very carefully, he says they davened shehayu titkayim malchus beis David. If the Tashbitz was really talking about the Second Temple period, he would not have said titkayim malchus beis David, because malchus beis David was not was not ruling in the times of the Second Temple. Malchus Beis David ruled in the times of the First Temple. And then they were exiled. And then who replaced Malchus Beis David? The Hashmonaim, the Hasmonean dynasty. That's who replaced the Davidic dynasty. So if he says in his responsum that Malchus Beis David should endure, it could be that he's talking about the First Temple. It could be that he's talking about the First Temple, in which case it may not be so much of an answer to our question about what they did during the Second Temple. But at the same time, if you want to say this is really referring to the First Temple, then it seems like, according to the Tashbitz, they were already davening Shmona Esrei before the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah had established it. So that is also a difficulty. So whichever way you read this, there's a difficulty. Either you don't know what to do with the Shatid Kayim Malchus Beis David in a time when Beis David's kingship did not exist, or you have to say, or this is an anachronism when it refers to the Shmona Esrei, because he's clearly talking about brachot that we know from the Shmona Esrei, and if the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah only established those brachot right before or at the very beginning of the Second Temple era, then how is he talking about the First Temple? So you have a difficulty whichever way you try to read it, I think, yeah.
Except for the fact that Hashmonaim were not supposed to be maintained. And so then could they believe that period would be very short and go back to Darkestone? Because one of the punishments that the Hashmonaim got was they were supposed to only be the Kohanim, not the Malchus. So it wouldn't be something that would ever die.
But then why would it say Shetit Kayim? Why wouldn't it say Shetachzor? Seemingly it would say Shetachzor.
I think because the point is that it's always going to be there, that there's the error.
Well, then why do we daven Shetachzor? It means to return.
The bottom line is literally, there is no real answer other than they change it.
He seems to think that they changed it. It's not clear that he's referring to the times of the Second Temple, but it's not so clear that he's not. What he at least opens up the surface area for discussion about is whether the text of the Amidah, the Shmona Esrei that we have today, was different. And it is very possible that the Tashbitz thinks that yes, the text of the Amidah that we have today is different, and that is why we have these contradictions. Absolutely, absolutely. If you go to LMS and you go downstairs to the Sephardic Minyan, the text of the Shmona Esrei there is not exactly the same. If you go upstairs to the main sanctuary and you look at an Ashkenazic sitter, it's a little bit different. So we'll talk a little bit more about those differences when we get to the post Second Temple period. Now, this idea, specifically as it relates to the Kohanim of our Mishnah, is mirrored in the Yachin. The Yachin is part of a commentary on the Mishnah written by Rabbi Yisrael Lifshitz. He was a 19th century rabbi in Germany. And he writes that, the title is on the bottom of page 1, but if you turn to the top of page 2, he says, this is him quoting Rashi. I put him on the text because it's his commentary on our Mishnah, but he's really quoting Rashi in the beginning of Brachos. He says, okay, Ritzei Hashem Elokeinu et avodat abcha Yisrael l'sheishu l'fil tam tekabel baratzon u'tihil ratzon tamir avodat yamecha baruch atah Hashem hamekabel avodat amo Yisrael baratzon. He says that the text that they said, the Kohanim said Ritzei, we asked how can they say Ritzei, so he says it was a different Ritzei. And this was it. This was it. It was who accepts in the present tense, because they were offering korbanot, who accepts in the present tense, blessed are you Hashem, who accepts the service of his nation Israel with favor. V'yesh omrim, and he says, and some say, v'shesimu be'arachat Hashem, she'otcha levadcha b'iran avod. Blessed are you Hashem, which is what we say on Musaf, of Yom Tov. Right before Birkat Kohanim, for you alone in awe will we worship. So you can see from at least the Yachin, and again it's really Rashi, that even if it says the Kohanim said Ritzei, they probably said a different Ritzei than the one that we have right now. We daven for the return of sacrifices. They daven for the sacrifices that they were already offering to be accepted. However, there is, this is not the universally accepted understanding that the Shemona Esrei, that the Anshei Knesset HaGadolah is different, establishes different than what we have now, even though really everyone agrees that there are tiny minor differences. But that we'll talk about in the post Second Temple Shir a little bit. But in terms of the actual Second Temple era, what did they daven in the Second Temple? So the Halachot Ketanot has a different approach to resolving this question. The Halachot Ketanot, the question being again of how they recited Shemona Esrei and davened for things that during Temple times they already had. So the Halachot Ketanot, is a very interesting sefer. The Halachot Ketanot was written by Yaakov Chagiz. Rabbi Yaakov Chagiz is known for his short and sometimes unconventional rulings. And he has a sefer called Halachot Ketanot. It's a sefer of Shailas and Shuvos, or Responsa. He was a Sephardic Rav from Morocco who lived in the 17th century. And here is an example of a very short Shuvah of his. In Halachot Ketanot, Chelek Aleph Siman Kuf Pei Vav, the second source on page 2, She'ela, here's the question. Im v'bayit sheni hayu mishanim min ha-nusach. If during Bayit Sheni, during Second Temple times, did they change the nusach of tefillah that we have today? And the questioner didn't ask this, but the implication is that they seemingly had to have done something, because otherwise they were davening for things that they already had, as we pointed out. So he answers teshuva, and this is his answer. He says, Hakol hayu omrim. No, they would say everything that we said, today. Everything that we say now, they would say. And what about those parts of the davening that were incongruent with their own station in history? So he says, Hayum etzapim l'melech ha-mashiach. They would hope for Mashiach, for the Redeemer to come just like we do, the Kibbutz Galia, and they would daven for Kibbutz Galia, for the ingathering of exiles, because as we discussed, many Jews did not come back with the advent of the Second Temple. Umalchus Beis David, and they davened for the return of the Davidic dynasty, just as we do. Venetu b'nei Chashmonai, as you said, and the Chashmonaim were punished, al shelo hechziru ha'atara liyoshana, because they did not return the crown to its rightful heirs, to the Davidic dynasty. So the Halachot Ketanot presents an alternative option to the narrative of the potentially of the Tashbits and seemingly of Rashi and the Yachin, which is that the text was different. He says they said the same things, and in fact there are many things that we daven for that even in Temple times they still had to daven for. Now he doesn't address specifically what they did with Ritzei, because that is something that they were, meaning he gives examples of brachot and he says that obviously they needed those things also, but he doesn't address, and we could agree with that, meaning yes, they still needed Mashiach, and yes, they still needed people to come back to the Holy Land, and yes, they still needed the Davidic dynasty to return, but what about those things that they already had? So he kind of uses in his examples, I think, the lower hanging fruit. The real question, I think, applies to Ritzei, and maybe even to Hashivah Shoftenu, to the return of the judges in the Sanhedrin, which did exist in those times. So the Chassam. So that's the Hashit of the Halachot Ketanot. I don't know how he would answer those questions. He doesn't seem to answer them directly, but he does seem to clearly feel that they said everything anyway. The Chasam Sofer writes something similar. Rabbi Moshe Sofer, in his Tshuvos, writes something similar. He writes, "Kishen nivne beis hamikdash bayit sheni v'hikrivu bo korbanos harei mevoar b'maseches Tamid v'yoma operakama debrachos." We read this mission in Tamid, and he points out a couple of other places in Shas that it appears. Shegam kohanim ba'avodatam hitpalulu shmone esrei ubarchu brichos yotzer or v'ahava rabba kamonu. And they did all those things just like us, exactly. V'lo od, and not only that. Elashit palalu al smichas Keren David amelech alav hashalom. They davened for the return of the Davidic dynasty. V'afo pisha yalachem malchus beis chashmonai v'hordus. Even though they still had kings, it wasn't the ones that they were promised. It wasn't the one that's supposed to be ruling. David HaMelech and his dynasty were supposed to be kings. So we've seen a number of positions. Let's just summarize what we've learned so far. We started out by noting that we have sources that attest to people praying seemingly parts of the Shemona Esrei after it was established by the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah. So, okay, it's a good sign. But when you look a little bit closer, it does raise some questions. Number one, why were the Kohanim davening for things that they were already doing? And number two, in general, why were the people davening? Why were they assigned the liturgy that prayed for? If the Shemona Esrei that we have nowadays is really what they used then, then why are they davening for things that they already had? And so one answer was the Tashbits. Maybe depending on how you read the Tashbits, is that they actually did recite a different text than the one we have today for that very reason. It is a contradiction. However, the Halacha Ketanot, as we just read, indicated that they did not change anything. He doesn't explain how they dealt with those incongruities, but he does say Hakol Hayu Omrim, that they said everything. And he doesn't really address the ostensible contradiction involved in such a position, but it does seem to be the position that he advocates. So we have some answers to our question, and it is possible, indeed, that they recited a different nusach, a different text than the one we have today. We're going to stop here for now, because this is really a two-part class. And like I said, next week, next time we meet, even though we left off on a bit of a question mark, it's because we really need a whole shiur to dedicate to what I want to put forth an idea, I think, that might answer our question. It'll answer the incongruity question, and it'll help explain tefillah in the aftermath of the second temple. So next week, I think we have some answers, and next week I think we'll learn even more answers, and I'm going to argue something that I think can even fill in some of the blanks of our questions here today. So as always, feel free to hold on to these, but if you do not want to hold on to them, you can put them up on the table and they will be put in Shemus, and looking forward to learning together in 2 weeks. Okay.